right. So our next presentation is from some of our colleagues at Dynamo, from Stefan Marais, Hannes van Rensburg, and Anesu Shuro. So Stefan is experienced in designing and implementing technology solutions for actuarial teams to achieve end-to-end automation. He is a senior manager at Dynamo at Analytics South Africa and leads the actuarial software team working in the actuarial and financial modeling platform Cycle, used by insurers in various markets around the world. His current focus is to automate and improve reserving processes, but he's also working on applying general learnings from process automation to the life insurance valuation, health insurance, and banking sectors. Hannes is Managing Director of Dynamo South Africa and also leads the technical development of the actuarial and financial modeling platform Cycle, used by companies in various markets across the world. He fulfills the HAF for a number of South African insurance companies and has worked as a corporate and pricing actuary in the UK before starting at Dynamo. Hannes acted as chair of the Short-Term Insurance Committee in 2016 and 17 and deputy chair in 2014 and 2015. Anesu is a fellow of the Actuarial Society of South Africa and certified enterprise risk actuary. Anesu manages Dynamo's consulting operations in South Africa. He has experience in capital, reserving, IFRS 17, and pricing in the South African and the UK markets. This experience has been a mixture of traditional consulting work, as well as helping actuarial teams achieve end-to-end automation and model best practice through the use of Dynamo's Cycle software. And Anesu is also a member of the STIC CPD subcommittee. Thank you.
Okay, great. So just to set the scene and introduce what we're talking about. So obviously, the three of us and a couple of colleagues that we work on some of this stuff with, we've been seeing a lot of stuff being presented at STIC, the convention, Gyro, ICA recently, and a couple of papers, etc., that people introduce. And there's a couple of, you can see there's a lot of effort to try and challenge the way actuaries are doing reserving or claims modeling within their technical teams. So I mean, one of the themes that's been very popular is finance and actuarial transformation. So really the focus being how do we make sure that we take our actuaries out of the data processes, out of the monkey work basically, and enable them to actually do what they're being paid to do or what they're skilled to do. So enabling people to focus on more of the actuarial decision making and insights. So there's a lot of automation happening, around data processes, around calculations and processes. I think of a couple of people involved in IFRS 17 right now and trying to think about how to automate processes, and as well reporting processes. How to streamline how you report to management, to reserve committees, to audit committees as well. And then there's also a focus around reserving framework and automation incorporating AI. So the focus is about trying to get the number right, and trying to make sure that you don't miss out on the trends. So there's like rules-based exclusions and selections frameworks being built around actuarial teams, and because I mean a lot of people be probably were. Couple of people here working with hundreds of triangles or maybe 50 triangles or whatever, and you it's very possible that you might miss out on the trends. It's very possible that for a specific line of business or for a specific portfolio you don't get it right. So these automation frameworks, they kind of enable people to predict stuff accurately. I think we presented something on diagnostic led processes last year. And one of the things that we're also trying to enable actuarial teams to leverage that kind of first cut of results, and then they focus a bit more on what's actually insightful at the time of reserving. And then there's obviously a bit more advanced methods that people are getting into, and we talked a bit about some of these Australian methods. and, you know, the payment per claim type methods, you know, the Munich chain ladder. And there's a lot of people doing, you know, work around compartmentalized reserving, individual claims methods, which is the topic for today, and generalized linear models. And all of this is an effort to try and see how can we enhance our toolkits. You know, there's a lot of technical work that actuaries do, a lot of technical work that we've gone through our education process that we're not leveraging on. And so it's a lot of these points that people are trying to see, how can we enhance our reserving processes and try and leverage all these important, you know, important technical concepts that we've learned. And with the advancements of technology and all these cloud-based systems that we're starting to use, you can actually do quite a lot, and you can actually, you know, get things right, make sure you're not missing out on any trends, and provide a lot more insight to management. So today we're going to talk about the individual claims modeling part of it. Stefan's going to give us a bit of background around it, and he's going to give us a bit more background around the methods that people are coming up with around individual claims modeling. Hannes is going to give us an intro to a method, which I think is very, very interesting. I find very useful. And and then I'm going to close it out with some of the practical practical implications that you're supposed to think about when implementing this.
Thanks, Anesu. Okay. Thanks, everyone, for the opportunity. It's great to be here. I guess it's like just taking a step back. It's hard to do a technical topic like this after a session like the previous one. So I hope you guys can adjust the mindset a little bit to more technical things. Okay, so I want to start off. If you can go to the next slide, please. I want to start off with just a question to the audience here. Why do we currently use triangles? Just a generic question. Why do we use triangles? Okay, no reserving actuaries here. Okay, you're trying to find a pattern. I guess that's what we do with reserving. But what I'm getting at is, why do we use triangles for reserving? Proven track record. Way to visualize claims experience in a summarized way, right? Okay. Okay. It's what we were taught. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's one of my points as well. Yeah. So separate claims in cohorts, understanding how the different cohorts develop. Okay, so separating into a key objective, which we want to analyze things separately.
Okay, we have two answers online. The one is to understand claims development and predict how we will have claims have now developed. And the other one is that it's easy to explain and understand.
Okay, I like that second one. Okay, it's easy, it's simple. Okay, next, just one forward, please. Okay, so this is just stuff. I was hoping everyone came up with these as well. But yeah, simple data representation. I guess another reason I thought of is it's a limitation of some legacy data systems. So this is in the context of using triangles versus perhaps individual claims data directly. So a lot of the legacy systems only allow you to produce triangles and not the granular data. Another reason is initially when these methods were developed, they were developed with a mindset of we don't have a lot of computing resources available, and actuaries aren't coders as well. Like it's like back in the 70s and the 80s. When they start doing this stuff, well, I guess the 90s more, it was easy to do in spreadsheets, like the first versions of Excel and those things. So you can't do individual claim stuff. Like Excel was limited to something like 100,000 rows initially, and then that .slxsx extension was then limited to million now. But I think, yeah, big lines of business, like the triangle transactions, it easily goes up to more than a million, even for like smallish classes. So the computing limitations is a big one. And then there's the argument of like, well, it's consistent, you know, like using triangles is consistent across markets, consistent across, like easily to compare them across different lines of business. And there's also like a wide range of developed techniques out there that you use on triangles, because that's another reason to use it. Okay. Next one, please. Okay, so let's just quickly revisit what are the main assumptions of the chain ladder. Okay, so the one is that we assume that the trends in the past are representative of the trends in the future. Okay, and the other big assumption is that claims across cohorts are generally homogeneous, or at least consistently. This is a struggle to pronounce that word for Afrikaans person, but heterogeneous. Okay. Cool. Thanks. Next one. Okay, so let's just break those assumptions down a little bit more. Let's look at the homogeneity assumption. So this is assumption for all aggregate triangle reserving techniques. It's all these Australian methods, the PP methods, the MCL, they all have the same underlying assumption. It's not just chain ladder. Claims actually arise from claims in a typical triangle are actually like the pricing actuaries did a lot of work to actually split them out into homogeneous subgroups, okay, and then we aggregate them together again and put them into one triangle, and so it's a heterogeneous risk groups being like together, and we actually expect that to form homogeneous claims. So that's one thing I thought of. And then if we just think of the changes in heterogeneity over time as well. So it often happens that the business mix changes over time. So the origin, the cohorts become less comparable. Okay. There's this paper written in 1997, where the guy actually pointed out, he's quite a famous actuary and statistician. He pointed out how the homogeneity assumption is frequently violated, especially in long tail classes. Okay, and those sort of liability classes. I guess we don't have much of it here in South Africa, but yeah, compared to the UK. Then the trends assumption. So assuming that the trends of the past are representative of the future. So monitoring is obviously very important. If we want to make sure that assumption holds, for example, for something like the chain ladder, we need to go and look at our data. We need to go and investigate. Are the trends actually the same? Like, have they changed over time? Do we need to adjust assumptions? Things like that. But aggregating these claims, you actually lose a lot of ability to actually look at the claim level detail and pick up claim level trends. So summarizing the claim amounts, you lose a lot of information. And we also often don't include the claim characteristics. Yes, we do segmentation sometimes, where we segment, for example, maybe motor accident into a separate triangle, maybe do a separate reserving exercise on that, or we segment by claim size or things like that, which does improve a little bit, helps us to separate it out and look at different trends according to the different triangles. But yeah, okay. Then there's another thing that we do is we don't even summarize a triangle. We also we should consider how we actually summarize these claim movements into the different cells in the triangle. For example, you'd have a movement, a claim was maybe reported 31 December. soon thereafter, which is a work day, soon thereafter, maybe like 3rd of January or something, there's already a movement on the claim. And maybe it might even be finalized in that same week. But in a calendar year, like it'll fall over in the next financial period. So it's a very short lag, but it actually it can distort the data. Like if you just compare it with other claim movements and things like that. And we typically get around that by doing monthly by monthly triangles or quarterly by monthly triangles. But yeah, then you have the whole seasonality issue where you're comparing like December trends versus compared to like March trends or things, and it's not really comparable anymore. Okay, so a whole bunch of questions that I'm asking, difficult questions, but yeah. So here's the argument. We have all these issues with our assumptions. Does this perhaps lead to the reason we consider reserving a bit of an art, not a science? Got that quote from someone recently. And also, so who here has ever taken a basic churn ladder, just took a volume weighted all, the volume weighted all pattern calculation, and just took the ultimate as is as your final reserve? Who has ever done that? Okay, there's always manual intervention needed. Okay, call it like actuarial judgment or something, yeah, tongue in cheek. But so these methods typically overstate or understate the reserves unadjusted. Okay, so we've also got a like wide range of established techniques of how we adjust these methods. We can do curve fitting on different forms. We can do like fancy kind of exclusions by diagonal, exclusions by rule-based exclusions, all kinds of fancy things, and we can apply weightings to the different cohorts. And typically when just how the market responds, well, how we as actuaries typically have been responding to perhaps volatility in a triangle past history, in your upper triangle basically, we just do BF, right? So as soon as things break down and chain ladder performs poorly, we there's a larger reliance on BF, or even like obviously the most recent origin periods, the limitation of BF is that of chain ladder is that it can't project it accurately necessarily if you don't have like sufficient data in your recent diagonals. But obviously using BF then you're now subjected to the limitations of BF, which is you actually making a subjective loss ratio assumption, and the exposure measure that you use is not necessarily representative of risks in that cohort necessarily. So like the exposure measure per cohort that you assume. And then on top of that, like reserving is actually like it can be a really time-consuming process, even for a subject matter expert. So that's the that. I hope that sets the scene a little bit. Like just looking at the limitations of our existing reserving methodologies. So also one of the reasons I think it's a time-consuming process is because we have to because the methods aren't as predictive as they can be. And we are required to make a lot of manual adjustments. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, cool. So introducing individual claims reserving. So I wish does this thing have a laser? No. Okay. So the first paper there, the first two people, so back in 1986, in the 80s and the 90s, those two people were the first to attempt to lay down like a framework for individual claims reserving. So it's not a new concept. There was this other paper, claims reserving in continuous time, a non-parametric Bayesian approach. Also an individual claims method that someone proposed. Those two guys. And then there's a bit of a jump like 10 years later. So I think it's the guys from Taylor Fry in Australia. They took this literature, and so they're really big in analytics and stuff. And they did this work and presented the paper, individual claims, loss reserving, conditioned by case estimates. Okay, so this is like a really good paper to go and look at if you wanna get a feel for what good individual claims methods are out there. So it's this paper actually includes also a study, a case study, that actually proves that these methods outperform aggregate reserving techniques. Okay, so it's the question is like, why? I guess if it outperforms it, why don't we use it? It's maybe a good question to ask. Like, is it too complex? Is it too hard for us to understand? Is it too difficult to implement? If it's better, why are we not using it? So there was other work done as well separately. So that semi-parametric model for prediction of individual loss reserving, claim loss reserving, 2009. But then, so looking at the papers, there was a bit of a gap. So there was a lot of work done, groundwork done in the early 2000s, well, late 2000s, I guess. And then there was a bit of a gap. About 10 years later only, like, it was picked up again. Like, people started doing new things. So I just want to sort of ask the question, like, it's really interesting to see, like, why is it like that? Recently, people have been picking it up again. There's a lot of recent papers on individual claims reserving again. So this paper at the end, the 2019 one, it's a really nice one to go and look at. It summarizes all the existing methods out there, the known methods. For example, there's a GLM, individual claims reserving method. There's a neural networks with cascading method, random forests with modified cascading method, support vector machines on triangle-free models. So it summarizes all those methods and compares them. It's a nice paper to go and look at if you want to get into the machine learning style individual claims methods. There's another paper that also describes using neural network on reported claims. You can see very recently published. But I love this quote. This is from the paper in 2019. With the booming of machine learning methods and the significant increment of computing power, the loss in information resulting from aggregation of individual claims data into accident and development year buckets is no longer justifiable. So it's the same argument I'm basically posing. It's like we're losing a lot of information, and there is an increase in computing power allowing us to be able to run these methods on individual claim level. Yeah, and then there's a boom in machine learning. So maybe we should look at this. So Hannes, okay, hope that sets the scene a little bit more.
Thanks, Stefan. Stefan and Ron is working on or submitted a paper for the convention around clustering, which gives quite a lot of insight into individual deriving features of individual claims. What I find quite interesting is you've got 2009 and then you've got 2021, and it just feels like for about 10 years, actuaries have got lost in regulatory work where, you know, we could actually be pushing forward with quite a lot of other interesting value-adding things. Next slide. So I'm going to... Please. I don't think this clicker's working. So in 2009, Claude Perret, myself, and a guy called Farshad Zanjani, we were working together in pricing in London, and we were pretty much faced with a kind of problems around needing to find an ultimate position for liability long tail claims. And we came up with a paper and a method, call it the Van Pajani method if you want, but it's not just a non-parametric approach to projecting individual losses to ultimate, so an IBM ER type method. Given that we in more practical we researched some method, but in the end we came up with something that worked for us and practically easy to understand. And when you work backward, it's kind of quite similar to a chain ladder, but at an individual claims level. So why did we come up with kind of our own method? I think at the time there was extensive literature on aggregate claims reserving. And there was kind of some methods available for separating kind of the pure IBNR from the IBN, the kind of your total cumulative loss development factor. But there was very few kind of papers on just IBNER. So how do we get a claim and get that individual claim to an ultimate position? And I think today there's kind of some new papers. I don't think it's in practice. There's probably not much change since 2009, which makes me think of obviously giving away my age there. It's been 14 years now. I think difficult to obtain and manage large granular data sets at the time. Stefan said, I think we still had a 70,000 row limitation in Excel back then. We moved past the kind of clip cards at least. But I think today it's easy. You can get a package of R or Python installed. Most of you have some kind of SQL or SAS experience. So I think we've moved on and it's easier for us to do these things today. I think IBNER is probably more important for pricing than reserving. Obviously for reserving, you want to make sure the total IBNR is sufficient. But back then, again, I think today we're realizing that we are losing a lot of information. If you think what goes into that triangle, it's settlement, it's first reporting delays, there's kind of exposure. So you might be writing completely different policies. There's differences in how people report, there's differences in how we handle claims. So there's settlement delays, there's transaction dates, there's a lot in there, and it kind of gets all kind of squished up into kind of a triangle. At the time, we came up with something that was kind of easy for us to understand and compare to what was familiar. Context of why we needed the method. So as I said, we were doing a pricing rate review for employers and public liability losses. Individual claims are very, the difficult word, heterogeneous, or however you say it, and long-tailed. And, when you do a GLM for motor, you just cut off the last 3 months and you kind of scale your exposure back. You're not that concerned about the most recent information, where for employees' liability, some of these claims take 10 years to settle. So you need some way to get those claims up to an ultimate position. These policies are subject to wide range of deductibles, there's large losses, there's poor exposure information on what the cause of the loss was. For us, the scope was broad, so we needed a claim severity index by year. So we were concerned about the individual positions by an accident or a report year cohort. We needed increased limits factors to scale up for excess of loss pricing. And we wanted to prepare data for predictive modeling. And then finally, we needed IBNER development factors to apply to individual claims when you do large case pricing. Next slide, please. So I think other reasons why IBNER projections of interest, pricing excess of loss contracts, pricing for changes in the deductibles. When you want to fit statistical distributions to an ultimate loss, we obviously need that final inflated developed loss position for all claims. Long-tailed business, you actually need to adjust the data. You can't just cut back or go back as far as you think is mature. For financial reporting, for insurance, reserving applications, which we hear today talk about, and deriving claims inflation indexes. I think the other, as Stefan alluded earlier, within kind of your development factor, so what we typically do is we smooth the patterns and we see kind of maybe we look at actual versus expected and we see how a claim development for this ratio or this cohort compares to your ultimate. So we do make adjustments, and if you experience, you kind of know, you go talk to claims and you're seeing payments are suddenly running ahead of what you expect. And there's kind of constant adjustment to methods and kind of picking of subjectively selecting which method is best. And I think there's a good actuary, a good reserving actuary does that, and it's great. But I think there's a lot of information that can actually tell you, automatically tell you what's actually happening without doing that subjectively. Cool. Next slide. So why didn't we use the available methods? I think we investigated many different methods, again, mainly on triangle basis. Many of these gave us IBNR at the aggregate level we were comfortable with, not really convincing at the individual claim level. And I think the general weakness is that when you do a chain ladder, you've got that heavy reliance on that latest position. So you've got a position and now you're projecting it with an average factor. What we found was there's quite a big difference in kind of small claims. That's kind of small, medium, and large by development. And it's sort of difficult to kind of know when a claim is large, and there might be certain rules around it. But in general, what we found was once a claim is large, there's been a lot of case estimation in there. There's been a lot of time put in that. When claims were small or medium, there's some claims that weren't identified yet but will go to large. So using kind of an average factor, you'd end up projecting large claims way too much on a large claim and too little on that small claim. So you ended up with kind of blobs of information, blobs of data, rather than a kind of a really nice distributed set of kind of ultimate claims per or individual claims. So looked at banding claims up by size, by percentile, different grouping things by accident or reporting cohorts, etc. And when we think of credibility, what we're trying to do is we're almost trying to get as much data into kind of homogeneous triangles to say, okay, well, by class of business, or we might within a class, we might split out, say, for motor, we might split out salvages and project that separately, for example, or look at third-party claims or liability claims separate to property. But we tend to group things so that we get a stability in patterns. And then what we would have liked to see at that time was we wanted credible for us. The definition would be if we look at an individual claim, we want that claim to be projected in line with other comparable claims. And we needed a way to determine is it comparable to that claim or not. Great. Next slide, please. So just practically, as I said, when you've got kind of an incurred, so this is just incurred claims, so 10 individual losses, we're looking at pricing a layer of risks, say 10 million, in excess of 10 million, and we've got a burn within the layer on incurred basis. So say by this, for example, it's 7 million rands in that layer. If we used our kind of reserving factor, that reserving factor for a new cohort to ultimate is 1.4. But if we project that, so all claims using that LDF, we project a very large number because most of that kind of 1.4 factor is actually driven by new claims. And new claims would potentially, you'd have another four claims actually coming to the right of the claim number 10 rather than projecting vertically into the layer. Next slide, please. So what you do in practice when you do large case pricing is you would try and split out that claims ratio, that factor, into a portion that's coming from new losses and a portion that's coming from development on existing losses. A simple way of adjusting it is to look at your reported numbers LDF. So you'll take your 1.4 and you'll divide it by the reported numbers loss development factor. In this case, it ended up being 1.15. So we projected the claims with a factor of 1.15 across the board and gave us a kind of an ultimate of 13.8. Alternatively, we looked at kind of grouping. We saw that large claims projected, there was a smaller development than small. So we looked at that kind of development factor by band and by projecting, say, the large claims by a factor of 1.05 and small claims by a factor of 1.25. We kind of get a better dispersion, which kind of had another difference in projected in the layer. So I think It's great to refine these methods. Just what we found is it was very difficult to know what threshold to use. There's, again, subjectivity introduced. Next slide, please. So the method, what you've all been waiting for. So at a minimum, all you need is individual claims. You need the transaction amount, so either paid or incurred or both, and the transaction dates. So that's all for to kind of use this method. That's all you need. If you want to refine it, you can either obviously look at the report date, so group it by a report date cohort, probably better for IB and ER. Maybe group it by type of loss, property damage, bodily injury. You can even look at it by claims handler if you think that people are very handle claims very differently, or by maybe by UMA if you have that, if there's kind of underwriting managers that drip feed information through to you, by deductible. So there's lots of other things you can group it introduce into the method. And what you'll find is the methods that we use is similar to clustering. So we want to calculate the distance, a distance measure for this claim relative to all kind of more mature claims in the portfolio. And when you look at clustering, what you're trying to do is you're trying to find a distance measure that tells you how should I group or cluster these claims into different homogeneous groups and then use those groups to project. Where what we tried to do was actually not assigned to a group, but give a weighting to a claim based on a distance calculation. Yeah, so some things around what you can do to prepare data, but I don't need to run through that now. Next slide, please. So pretty much what you do is you've got your incurred claim, and I'll show an example in a minute, and at each development period, you compare the claim to all other claims that's more mature in the portfolio. And we calculated a distance as the difference between that incurred position of the projected or claim we want to project to the comparison claim. Took the absolute value because obviously a claim can be either higher or lower, and calculated that distance. And then we had a weight that we applied to each development period. So if you know that a claim is 5 years old, the claim sits at the 5 million amount. And you can see that other large claims from 5 years onwards don't really move much, then obviously you'd say that at that point, I want to give as much credibility to that claims in the same kind of claim band. Again, if a claim is kind of very large in the first period and you look at historic losses, you'd see some of those will probably settle at near zero when it's repudiated. Some of that might develop strongly after that if it's, actually more information becomes available. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to give more weight to the more recent periods, but we are interested in the way that the claim developed. Is it a claim that's kind of started out slowly and then developed strongly? Is it a claim that's immediately reserved quite high? What typically happens to those claims? Do we see a reduction? Some companies are very prudent in their initial estimates. They want to kind of develop at the limit, for example. And we took kind of a power formula in our weighting, being kind of the development period to the power of 0.75. So I'll talk about what it means. If you give kind of a power out of zero, you say that if the claim is comparable in period 1, 2, 3, 4, at each point in time, the weight is similar. You want to give equal weight to all periods. If you put a alpha to the 1, then every new development period you give kind of double the weight. So 0.75, we tested it and it made sense to us. But that's something that you can fit. I mean, you can statistically solve probably what that factor should be. And then if you look at the chain ladder, it's actually a special case of this method where the weights is then based on the size of the claim, and not necessarily the difference in claim size at each point in time. So that's also quite nice, is that you can actually change or pick your weights to get similar results to what a chain ladder would give you. Next slide, please. So just an example. So I've got a kind of a claim I want to project. Three periods. It's kind of 3 periods mature. I've got a claim that I compare that to, and I can calculate the distance between the claim at each point in time, so using the formula I just showed you, and it gives me kind of a distance percentage. The distance percentage, so if you look at kind of 10% there, at age 3, I want to say that, you know, if a claim is, so that's alpha to the power 0.75, if it's, if the distance is twice as wide as period 1, I consider that to be similar in distance. So I'm kind of giving more credibility to, I allow for a bit more deviation the further I go into the future to determine that likeliness formula. And then cumulatively, I then sum distances and I will look up the likeliness for that period at that point in time based on the cumulative distance. The likeliness, because it's kind of an absolute value, a 2% distance is a 4% likeliness. So it's 1 minus twice the distance. So that's kind of similar to your clustering algorithms. Just go to the next slide, please. Power of 0, so it's similar, just shows that the distance percentage and the likeliness percentage varies. So in this case, a bit smaller if I give equal weights to each point in time. Next one. So I think what's really good about or nice about this method is I can now say this is my projection claim, and I can look at 5 different kind of almost empirical outcomes for this claim based on how 5 other claims have developed. So on the graph, you could see I've got kind of 5 losses. I've calculated a distance or likeliness to each claim, but the outcomes I can plot. I can plot the 5. So the light blue one had a bit of a reduction, then it kind of shot up to a kind of a higher amount. There was 2 claims that started out and then reduced over time. And by looking at those percentages, I can scale those likeliness percentages to 1. So I can actually, so it gives me kind of an empirical development for that claim based on the individual claims and how they've developed. So however you then choose to say how likely would it be that the claim develops up or down, that's, you can come up with your own likeliness method. We just pick that. But the red line then is effectively what you would see in your chain ladder. It's just a kind of a weighted sum of the outcomes. It's quite similar to a bootstrap, but at an individual claim level. So rather than having to group everything and then resample development factors, which again is summarized, you know, you've got 100,000 claims summarized into a 9x9 triangle, or you group it quarterly and then you get completely different volatility factors. This gives you kind of a way to do those variability modeling at an individual claim level as well. Great, next one. So just some of the output from the method we found very helpful. So we saw that, you know, large claims in that 750 to 1 million band, kind of that largest band we looked at, you had cumulative development factors that's lower than, I'd say, the really small losses. So it would make sense. See, if in those claim bands, if initially there's no reserve place, there's no information, some of those claims will go up to big amounts. You only need a handful of large movements to distort your kind of small claims development factor. And likewise, you see that in the coefficient of variation of how claims have actually developed in the past, you can see that, you know, that's a much higher coefficient of variation at period 1 to almost throughout. So once you get to period 6, you're kind of similar. But So large claims, so claims that have kind of have an initial review in the first few development periods, they show a lot less variation because they are already assessed and they looked at. So, yeah, intuitive, but again, quite easy to understand, and quite useful for pricing because you don't necessarily want to load large claims with those types of large kind of development factors. Next slide, please. Okay, so I guess that's quite a lot of time has passed when we kind of came up with it. Why are we looking at it today? I think we kind of as a business investing quite a lot of time into AI and trying to encourage automation of reserving and automated selections, I think what we found is that looking at triangles, we just found it very hard to come up with AI or automatic kind of selection methods that's credible at every point in time. And so we started kind of just looking again at more granular methods, granular information to inform the models on how to make decisions without the actuarial judgment coming into play. I think today also people are more comfortable with handling big data, so more people in our team can look at it and it's more accessible. And I think it just feels like we're kind of stuck in the past a bit with the methods that we're using. And, I think as that kind of paper that Stefan alluded to, it's quite a bold statement to say, you know, is it still justified to pick a cohort and just use that method? It'd be interesting to see how kind of accurate our reserving, you know, is kind of on a consistent basis, just using an aggregated set of information that's really just could be distorted. I think the aggregate basis restricts typically, apart from the segmentations, you apply to two features. You know, it's a cohort and where you are in your maturity. I think when you start playing around with these things, you start appreciating how much information we're actually losing. One other thing we're thinking about, even when you've got your kind of GLMs, you've got a pure loss cost model at a policy level that allows for all these features. So, you know, a very easy way that we could start coming up with our BFs or our kind of that prior ultimate position could literally just be to take that pricing model, come up with the loss cost per risk, and that's the kind of the aggregated prior ultimate, and that's done at a policy level or at a policy level without us really doing anything. And this is useful for IBNR because we can say at this point in time what would we have expected, but it's actually useful for projecting what's next month's claims and the months after, and for planning for unexpired risk. There's quite a lot of stuff we can do without, you know, just starting with the models we already have. Maybe just get the pricing guys to share it with you. Next one. Is that you? Cool. So I'm done. Thanks.
Cool. So, I mean, just chat about some of the practicalities and then we'll move on to questions. So obviously, like, some of reserving actuaries, although we probably discovered there's no reserving actuaries in here, but if they were, they would be asking themselves the question, so how do we actually implement this? This is all well and good, but I'm struggling to get through a reserving process every month already with what I have. How do I now also add this to my toolkit? So obviously, the first part, you need to get the data. So obviously, bordereau information is not going to cut it. So you need to think about how can you actually get all those that individual claims detail. And some of our pricing teams, they're already going through processes to actually get more detailed information. You know, IFRS 17 is pushing people to also think more about getting detailed data to enhance modeling and to comply with the regulation. And then the other thing that will basically empower you to do all of this stuff is having an automated reserving process. I recall last year we talked about diagnostic-led reserving, where you take more of a bottom-up approach to your reserving. So what's limiting people from doing more extensive analysis of this nature is the fact that they're caught in the data, etc. They're starting from a bottom-up approach and trying to then get to the results, and then you've done a late night, and then now you have to go to the committee. You don't know why it's driving your results. You don't know why your results look like that. But if you start, from the top going down, you actually add more insights. You actually do more of the granular analysis and make sure that you get all the insights that you need. So, as you do that, there's obviously an investment into establishing your approach or your reserving process that enables this individual claims modeling. You start obviously with you could start maybe with lines of business that require a lot more of the analysis. So Zanis mentioned, you know, liability. Normally you go to reserve committees and there's this case estimates or sensitivities on case estimates that's sitting in your triangles, but no one actually knows the finality of it. So us focusing a bit more on those lines where we can add more value to the decision making and provide scenarios and other outcomes that could actually play out in practice. And then there's classes where, you know, like treaty excess of loss, where it's naturally individual analysis would obviously be better because there's a lot of individual, you know, claims nuances that you actually want to model in your process. And then for some classes, you can then decide, okay, maybe the stable ones I model on an aggregate basis, and then maybe for other ones you do aggregate on your attritionals, but large losses maybe you look at a bit more on an individual basis. And then some of the stuff that you obviously have to announce in your process is, you know, developing cycles or including development within your reserving process. So, you know, changing your reserving team from just a compliance function to a team that's actually sitting, you know, and adding value to the business and having some development functions. So some of the bigger teams we've seen, they will have like a development team which is focused on, you know, doing all these specifications, announcements, calibrations during the downturn. And then there's a BAU team that's responsible for the reporting and booking process. But obviously some teams are small, and then you actually try and see how you can provide cycles within your delivery where you're not doing your quarterlies, you're thinking more about enhancing your process, etc. Also thinking more about adding new features and covariates. So obviously there's a lot that could infer the finality of your claims. So particularly with liability claims, could be features of the litigation process that you can incorporate. But this is all analysis that can be done if you leverage an automated reserving process that gives you enough time to do all this analysis. If you can go to the next slide, please. And then obviously having good governance around your process. So obviously what's key is having, if you have some automated way of producing some of this stuff, you know, like model changes, audit trails, and judgment logs. So obviously having an individual claims process is fine, but you need to tell a story about what you've done. You need to go in front of auditors, you need to go in front of reserving committees, and you need to actually, you know, you need to say what you've done in your process to get your ultimates. You need to think also about providing inference around your method. You need to think about how do you extend, and you know, there's all these methods even from an AI perspective, and there's a lot of work being done around explainable AI and trying to get inference out of our modeling. So you need to sit down as well during the development phases and think, how do we get more inference? Because management and reserve committees, audit committees, the getting the best estimate is fine, but they want to understand, you know, what's the driver? What's actually causing things to be like this? Why do you think the claim is going to end on that basis? And then obviously communicating uncertainty. A lot of people are involved in and IFRS 17 risk adjustment modeling. So thinking about how do you actually, is my method also enabling me to model that whatever percentile you're trying to target as well. And of course, ensuring consistency between your different actuarial processes within your organization.
I actually want to know, after you apply this method, did you compare, how does it compare with the previous method? Or how usually you would actually calculate the reserve? Because I guess one of the difficulties or one of the reasons why people don't adopt these methods is the fact that because the reserving is a result in financials, you want to sort of make sure there's consistency in the result itself. Now, I don't think management will like to have a, like at one stage your IBNR was a certain value, and the next value, the next valuation, it's a different value. So I want to know, did you maybe do any sort of analysis, and would you then think it's possible to then still sort of argue why you would still change a number so drastically?
Okay. So I guess in terms of consistency, I mean, Anis had another slide where he also showed, you know, like what an aggregate method would look like. But we're not saying you should, I think we were talking about that when we were walking here, we're not saying you should let go of your aggregate methods, but then we're saying, if you have an automated process, I know it can be taxing if you don't, if you have an automated process, you should be able to leverage all those methods and have some dashboard that you're looking at that's got, you know, the results of all the ultimates, etc. And then maybe one method has got a higher ultimate than the other one, and then you do that. That's the deep dive that you're supposed to do as an actuary to unravel those trends and try and see, okay, what is this method telling me that this one isn't telling me? Rather than you spending time, you know, in the data, etc., you're actually challenging all that stuff. And then by the time you go to your committee, you're equipped with that the knowledge to know, you know, what's going to be important. So you're still going to have all of those methods running, and then you have some dashboard that's got all the ultimates from the different approaches, and then you critique. Yeah. I don't know if you want to add more.
Yeah, I think I think all the methods, as Anesa said, the aggregate methods are really good to see that consistency. So you know, okay, I've got my incurred chain ladder last time and this time, and I have the results, and I can do an actual as expected on an incurred method or paid method. But I'm just looking at just the Reserve Committee recently where that one of the class only have pay data, and the business itself looks at, they would say they had a great month because they had few payments, and so internally, and then next month they had a poor month because there was lots of payments made. And then you allocate it to cohorts, and you see actually on a cohort basis it's not necessarily good or bad, it's just that they're tracking behind, you know, they actually, there's claims, once those claims comes in, it's going to, you're going to end up with the same ultimate if you then look at the incurred method. The problem is, I just find you sit in a lot of, not arguments, but there's a lot of kind of discussion around, is the payment speeding up? Are we tracking behind? Is it settlement delays? Is it? And then in the end, you, for the most recent period, what you end up doing is you select maybe a BF, or you smooth out that process. So for the most recent periods, you sometimes, it's 2-3 months before you actually see the picture. If you look at individual claims, or maybe even the next step, so if you look at just numbers-based methods, you'd be able to see, you know, my reporting numbers are actually the same as it was last month, but I've settled a lot less. So immediately, no, the paid method isn't actually giving me the full picture of the ultimate. But you do that, you investigate all these things. When you've got individual methods, the method itself would tell you these things. And I think that's the point here. It's not throw out the chain ladder or throw out anything. It's just, if the incurred is suddenly projecting much higher than the paid, is it the right thing to take the average? Should I ignore the paid? Shouldn't I? And without knowing what's happening to that underlying reporting delay, settlement delay, that type of thing, it's always going to be subjective, which is great, but it'd be nice if a method could tell you these things.
Thank you guys for the presentation. This side? On your right side. Thank you. So I have two questions. First one is there a place we can maybe find out more or research more about the method? And then the second one is on your point where you said sometimes for some of the attritional claims, you can just use them on an aggregate basis and then use the individual claims method for some of the larger claims. So my question on that is, how does the method handle scarcity of data once you get to those larger claims? Because that's usually an underlying problem.
Yeah, again, I think when you split into attrition and large, I think the issue that you have there is that you don't know when attritional claim is going to become large, and you know when a large claim is going to, not going to model the kind of, well, you will model the reduction in the large probably. No, I think with all of these things, there's limitations. So I think your chain ladder at the moment, it will just group everything together, and it will give all the attritional development kind of overstate the emphasis or the weight that the large claim is giving you, because it's weighting on the size of the loss. So I think in terms of how delays, I think if you say make your threshold low enough, then you know you would still give the large claim development a weighting from every other mid-sized claim, every other medium-sized claim would also have similar development lags. But yeah, if you've only got one claim and you've not had anything develop before, then you're kind of back to talking to claims handlers and seeing where it's going. So yeah, the method's not going to solve, unfortunately, every limitation that's there, but at least it gets you thinking about, you know, how these individual things move. And I can give you, happy to send you a spreadsheet of just that likeliness calc. If you just find me afterwards, I'll give you my details.
Hannes, thank you for the presentation, guys. Yes, I must say, Hannes has got, if you didn't see it, he looks like Gay Corsten. He's very comfortable with the microphone. He must have karaoke'd a lot, you know. That's fine. One observation, one question. I do agree that if I look at climate change coming and just this, you know, the frequency and severity misbehaving, I think the time is ripe to, you know, explore individual loss reserving. Plus, you know, there's other precursors there that already wasn't there years ago. But I think the pressure for us as an industry to start looking at it is probably going to mount more in the future. Just turning it the other way around, they say there's two types of people. Those of us who learn from mistakes, and then the rest of us just have to make the mistakes. So I want to know, if I think about Lloyd's syndicates, especially XOL providers or non-prop providers, they're probably one of the best fruitful areas to explore and use techniques like this. How widely is this being used as one of the methods to try and explore the variability in their portfolio in kind of a Lloyd's syndicate setup?
So Andre, you're talking about this specific method or just individual claims methods? I must say it's been a bit dormant, actually. I haven't really followed up. I mean, that presentation, yeah, if you look at, so it's on the Institute's website, we put spreadsheets, SAS code, everything like you could possibly use. I've been trying to find those resources. I must say, I was looking back quite disappointed with the take up of what we thought would be quite an easy way into an individual method. I think a lot of syndicates, reinsurance providers, would definitely have individual claims methods. We've got quite a few clients that have individual methods, but it's not necessarily. But does look at individual methods, but it's not really formulaic always. I think they might look at a specific claim and see how that's developed, and still apply LDF derived on portfolios, but look at it on an individual loss basis. So yeah, I'm happy to share our method. I think the coming up with a likeliness. There's probably much more you can do if you're smart and you've got insights and you can read mathematical papers. But I'm hoping to see this move forward now that IFRS 17 has died. But no, I haven't had anyone come to me and say, oh, the method you guys published in 2009 is now taken off. I've had one request from a client that's asked us to do individual claims methods, now that we've published that, but that was a specific request. So if anyone wants to run with it and share your insights, it'd be really, really good, really interesting.
Thanks so much, everyone. So we're going to have a coffee break now, and if we can all be back here, I think we'll start the next session at 11:35, just to give the extra 5 minutes that we've gone a little bit over. Thanks so much.